Hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, People's Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web, www.kpfk.org. I'm on the phone with M. Tangalise Sinika with the African American Leadership Project in New Orleans as we approach the first anniversary of the racist catastrophe of Katrina. We're going to try to talk about what we can do about it. How you doing, brother?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'm just trying to help rebuild the city.
Well, that's quite a journey. I think you know I've just completed a book called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction, New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. In terms of the beginning of the question of rebuilding the city, what's happened to the demand for the right of return? What is your organization trying to do to get what we estimate, I'm sure you do too, as 250,000 black people that have been dispersed and now forcibly kept out of New Orleans by the government? What do you think is the plan to get them back, get them home?
Well, first let me say to your listening audience that we would like to cordially invite those of you who are interested to join us in this anniversary observance of Katrina. We will have a lot of discussions and workshops. We will do a hand around the dome for as a healing ritual. We'll have marches. We have a variety of things, and I want to invite you to come and join us in that discussion and bring some of your books.
Well, just so you know really quickly that myself, Damon Azali, Patrice Cullors, Francisco Porchas, and Mark Anthony Johnson are going to take you up on it. Now, that's pretty fast service, right? You asked for it. We're going to be there August 21st.
Oh, okay.
So we're coming down, books and all, and we'd love to join you. Tell us about the hands around the dome. Why don't we start there? That's a good is your organization instrumental in helping to initiate that project?
No, that's our project.
Okay, tell us about it.
We initiated that as a way to bring people together to remember the suffering that our people went through, the loss of life, those who risked their lives in communities and neighborhoods to save others, and to honor their memory, if you would, and to suggest that we, the people, are capable of claiming our own history and remaking and reshaping our community. So the Hands Around the Dome is a way... Okay, is a way to symbolically make that statement and other statements as well. We will join hands around the dome. We will recite the names of those who were lost. We will feature the persons of the families from those who were lost. We will have singing. We will have drumming. We will have music. We will have prayer and reflection. We're hoping that this Hands Around the Dome ceremony could have been repeated in Houston around that dome, and we're still working on that idea as a powerful national symbol. So the Hands Around the Dome is saying we will break the chain of pain, and we will turn our backs to the suffering that we experience as we learn from the lessons and the mistakes, as we critique the institutions that made those mistakes, and as we express our hope for an equitable, just, and democratic New Orleans in the future. Another major event is the People's Hurricane Relief Fund is organizing a Great Flood commemorative march on the 29th, leaving from the Lower Ninth Ward to Congo Square. That is intended as a highly involved, I think, political analysis of what happened. We're supporting that, encouraging everybody to participate in it. And we're proud to say that the previous plans that involved fireworks and comedy shows and parades has been canceled. The voices of the people were heard, and the city has dissociated itself from that, and that's not going to happen. So we're very, very proud of that. We will have a national dialogue on the 25th. People like Mark Boreal and Julian Malveaux and Ron Daniels will be joining us for that. We'll have a lecture series on what happened to the Levis by Ivan Van Heerden. We're trying to get people like Cornell and Mike Dyson, you know, in for comments and analysis. We will also review the UN report that was released on the human rights violations. We will be, you know, in taking a look at that, and we'll have interfaith worship services. We will show the Final Call DVD during during our programs, and we'll talk about how to memorialize Katrina. What's the best way people can do that? So we've
okay.
got a full schedule.
Sounds good. Now I'm on the phone with M. Tangalisa and Sinika from the African American Leadership Project, who's discussing the different actions on the first anniversary of the devastation of Hurricane Katrina.
And I do want to come back to your issue of return.
Right? Yeah, which we will right now. I mean, one of the things that it's like you've lined up an excellent set of programs. We'd love to participate when we come down. We certainly would love to watch and listen. What if the problem is, like in my book, we discuss history can guide us. What if the history of this country is such that it is really it is deaf to a moral appeal, that the white power structures, we would say, that white racist structures of America know that there's 250,000 missing black people? What if they want them missing? What if that's their goal? What if the goal was to make New Orleans smaller, whiter, richer?
I think that is accurate. That is their goal. And it's been their goal before Katrina, however. You
That's
have to
right.
contextualize this. Pre-Katrina, we had an elected mayor whose policy orientation was far more aligned with the white business elites of the city than it was the suffering masses of our people, who constitute, by the way, the majority of African Americans in the city.
That's right.
And there were significant social movements on the ground that were challenging the behavior of this administration. There was movements around the police, movements around the schools, movements around the residency rule, movements around economic development, blackouts of the French Quarter. All sorts of things were going on pre-Katrina that already made the statement that our people were living in a disaster in New Orleans, with high levels of poverty, as much as 40% in some neighborhoods, 35-40% of our children, you know, not completing high school. The black-owned businesses were only 14% of the total, yet we're almost 70% of the population. The disparities go on and on and on. The statistics already made the argument. What Katrina did was to expose to the whole world the nature of the race, class, and gender, I might add, conflict in the city. It made clear that if you were resource limited based on being black, being female, being working class or poor, that you were vulnerable to disaster that was the result of naturally induced, a human induced natural disaster.
That's right.
Or any other kind of social disaster, that there's a segment of our population that was extremely vulnerable. That's what was revealed in Katrina. Now, as soon as that happened, the white power elites basically started arguing that God had done for them what they hadn't been able to do, which is to purge the city, and this is my language, to purge the city of its black population, and then to keep them out of the city by making it difficult for them to return physically at first, and then subsequently to economically return. You see, because the right to return is asserted as the right of internally displaced persons. We assert that as a legal right. It doesn't have the same strength of international law as a refugee, but it's still an asserted right that we believe has merit and value to it as IDP, internally displaced persons.
Right.
But if you don't have affordable housing, and remember, HUD has refused to allow the public housing population to return. That's, you know, some numbers say as much as 40,000 people of our people right there. And if you were a homeowner, you see, you could do something to your property. But if you were a renter, you were at the mercy of the landlord. Now, those apartment complexes that have reopened in New Orleans, rents have doubled. And there's no evidence that New Orleans will remain as an affordable city. So you can assert the right as an inherent human right or as a valid legal right. But at a practical level, no housing. The number of jobs is still limited, although they're looking for instance, in the construction industries, they're looking for almost 20,000 workers now. But you got to have housing. If the healthcare system is dysfunctional and if the schools are not working, If you don't have infrastructure operating in some places, transportation problems, for instance, still some problems with electricity and utilities, then the right to return remains abstract. So what we're saying is that the delivery of services and rebuilding of the city is a sine qua non, that is a prerequisite for the right to return to have very much meaning. Unfortunately, so much of this rebuilding has been controlled externally through Congress and through Baton Rouge, and not by the City Council of New Orleans, and certainly not by the mayor of New Orleans. So once again, we're trapped into a dependency position because our state capital in Baton Rouge and something called the Louisiana Recovery Authority will be in control of most of those federal dollars that are targeted for rebuilding the city.
And just hold on a second. I just want to each time let the listeners know we're on the phone with him, Tangalisi Sinika, with the African American Leadership Project. And one of the things which you said really brilliantly is that similar to the great epidemics that killed Native Americans, and then the white Christians showed up and said, God works in mysterious ways to advance our objectives, we've inherited some land that wasn't ours. Here we have the right-wing agenda, as you really pretty brilliantly, if I can say, put it together pretty quickly. So if you deny people housing, people, I hear, are almost trying to break into public housing to get
Absolutely.
Back into their own,
Absolutely.
Just to hand wipe mold off the wall with their own hands, and that's being treated as a criminal instead of, you know, when black folks even want to fix up public housing that they don't own, it's considered a crime. Then you have the role of the New Orleans Police Department, the National Guard, and the state troopers, who are now, is this true? Tell us a little bit about what the increased militarization. And also, again, I had one thought I want to ask you. If their goal is to make it unaffordable, illegal, inhospitable, isn't it necessary for people to physically still be there? In other words, isn't one of the dynamics that if the folks wait for the system to change these conditions, we will have lost the black majority in New Orleans necessary to change the very conditions that the system doesn't want to?
No, well, I agree with you there. And what is happening is that the people are in motion with or without the city's consent. That's what happened with the public housing. That's what people are going to do. They say, we're going to go take our housing units back, we'll clean them up, and we'll live in them. That's the level of environmental cleanup. We have huge environmental problems, but neighborhoods are starting to say, we'll initiate our own training programs and apply for the dollars necessary, you know, for the technical people to come in, but we're not going to wait for the government to tell us that we can't clean up our neighborhoods. Just in the city itself, there's some 90,000 permits have been issued through City Hall for people working on their houses. So every chance people get, people will come home and take control of whatever they can take control of. The problem is such a large percentage of those who are in the diaspora do not have the resources or the capacity to come home and to do that.
That's right.
Effectively. And so they get blocked out of the circuit that I just described, because the circuit that I just described is one that is primarily engaged in by people who own property. Whether it's a $50,000 home or a $500,000 home, people who've owned the property have tended to come back, gut their properties out, reclaim them, and work on rebuilding them. But people who are renters, which was the majority of African Americans,
that's right,
don't have the chance to do that. And that's what is so problematic with being in the diaspora. But being in the diaspora is difficult at another level. I reside in Houston and commute to New Orleans. But these cities where we've been dispersed to, I think that the Katrina welcome wagon has closed down. I don't think they want us in the cities, in those cities we've been dispersed to, the way it was one thing when we first got there, because everybody's heart was open. But as the demands to service this population have become clear, it's difficult for some cities to keep up the welcome invitation, although huge profits have been made off of our misery. Let me make something clear. These billions of FEMA dollars that have gone to apartment dwellers, apartment owners, and have gone to stores. I mean, in Houston alone, 35,000 to 40,000 apartments were subsidized directly by the government. So somebody made a lot of money and still is still making a lot of money off of Katrina. So when people think about government largesse, they should ask who really economically benefited from Katrina. Even though we may have gotten some direct help, the majority of that money leaked right back into the hands of other people who control this country. That's another issue. But the other central point that you're making is if you deprive people of the quality of life and the services they need, then you keep them out without saying officially that that's what you're doing. And that is the intent. New Orleans is a gateway city. It is needed for commercial trade, especially of agricultural products that come down the Mississippi River Valley. Its port is an important location for petrochemical and gas products to be flowing through the rest of the region, as well as the South American rim, the Caribbean rim, and parts of the European rim. So commercially, those who own the capital, who are sometimes called the bourgeois sector, some just flat out call them capitalists, some call them the elites, whatever, by whatever name you call them, those who own and control the wealth of this country will not, repeat, will not allow New Orleans to die. That's not a debate. New Orleans will live. But what is at stake is what shall be its human character. Shall it be a place that is a democratic, just, equitable, and sustainable city that has eliminated its racial inequalities and its racism and its gender exploitation and its cultural denials to some people? Or will it be a city that is open to all societies and cultures as it traditionally has been, where the African and Caribbean and Native American and European and Hispanic and Asian cultures have always had their impact here? It is truly a cultural gumbo. Will it continue to be that city, or will it be a monochromatic Euro-American middle-class presence in which the African and other people of colors are continuously marginalized while all this commercial trade and visitor tourist industry flourishes? That's the question.
Well, and I think we know the answer if we don't do anything. This is
if
Eric,
we don't struggle.
If we don't struggle. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. That very articulate man you've been listening to is Mtangalisi Sinyika of the African American Leadership Project. Boy, I wish you ran for mayor and gave Ray Nagin and Landro a run for their money, because you really can preach that gospel here. In the next 3 minutes, let's get back to asking people to either come to New Orleans on the first anniversary or do something for this community. As I said, five of us are going to come down there from the Labor Community Strategy Center. We look forward to meeting you.
Sure.
We look forward to the, you know, we work with Kali Akuna. We work with Malcolm Suba, who's going to be on the show next.
Oh, yeah. My good friend.
Yeah, absolutely. Good people. And we're going to, what can folks do? Concretely, back then, people knew at least give money some vague way for relief. But if these demands are going to be kept, what can people do in the realm of political activity around the first anniversary?
Well, I think one of the things we can do together is to ensure that there is the presence of a permanent, politically conscious and aware group of networks on the ground, that we make sure that we can organizationally support and sustain the progressive voices that are needed to wage this long-term battle. We live in a very fragile environment in New Orleans that has a certain history of social movement development, but certain constraints as well. And to the extent that we have allies and friends from outside of New Orleans who help to sustain the presence of a progressive voice, that is one of the major things we can do. Now, let me give you a practical example of what we need. What's the name of your radio station?
It's KPFK-FM in Los Angeles.
We need KPFNO in New Orleans.
That's you. You sure do.
Yeah, we need progressive radio. I live in Houston, and I love KPFT. I know KPFA in Berkeley.
That's right.
We need KPFNO.
All right.
One practical thing that your Pacifica Radio Network, if you want to do something to help us, help us set up a progressive radio station for New Orleans, like yours, that deals with the issues that we're struggling with.
Well, powerful person that I am, having one radio show and being director of a civil rights and environmental justice organization, that's a very serious proposal. That's a really brilliant proposal. I think you know it takes a tremendous amount to actually make that happen.
Oh, yes.
But why don't we, seriously, when we get down there, rather than just sort of say it, I think it's a really brilliant idea. And when we come down in a week, why don't we seriously have this conversation in more depth? And then we can come back, write to different people on the Pacifica board, call certain people. I think it's a really excellent, one of the most concrete suggestions I've heard. And we can at least make the responsibility on Voices from the Front Lines to take your proposal seriously and learn a little bit more of the channels, as they say, and the mechanisms to make such a request as a serious one.
Yes, well, it is a serious one, and I've been trying to reach out to other media sources. We also lack a daily newspaper that's an alternative to the Voices of the Establishment. And so the message is manipulated oftentimes and controlled externally. We need to be able to reach our people, and we do have some ways to do that, don't get me wrong. But what we lack is the kind of disciplined messaging that is possible through the Pacifica Network. Because of the way you are designed, structured, and funded, you're able to do that, and thus your message doesn't have to be manipulated, and it doesn't have to be watered down, and you can pretty much reach your constituency in a consistent way. We need a voice like that in our environment today, because this is a long-term struggle.
And we're going to leave it right there as a long-term struggle, because I want to get on Brother Malcolm Suber, who's going to come on right behind you.
All right. Brother Malcolm, I said hello.
I will. So you've been listening to Mtangalisi Sinyika, the New Orleans-based African-American Leadership Project, the call for a very serious proposal about a KPNO, L.A., and we're going to work it out. I look forward to seeing you in New Orleans, and thank you so much for your participation in the show.
My brother.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.